Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Alexandra Hemon, whose latest novel, or latest book, let's call it, is The Lazarus Project. Earlier books include The Question of Bruno and Nowhere Man, and I'm very clear that the word novel is borderline for you. Lazarus Project is definitely a novel. The other two are not. But I want to start with the fact that you kind of don't like the term novel.
I don't like the term novelist either, it seems like. It is something that limits the space that I want to work in. When I was writing The Lazarus Project, I could not refer to it as a novel, although I knew it would not be a book of short stories, and I referred to it as the big book. It was only after I had turned in the manuscript to my editor that one day I realized it is in fact a novel. And it seemed to me that, and it still does, that one, or I at least, I have to earn the right to call it a novel. It is not something that I can simply decide to write. I have to write a book, and then if it becomes a novel, then so be it. I'll call it a novel.
So you don't work with anything like an outline?
Well, I guess you could call it an outline. I call it a framework. The space that I want to spend time in is delimited with certain events. I knew that, you know, this book would be organized about the killing of Lazarus Averbach, and the two of them, the narrator and the photographer, would go to Eastern Europe. And I knew there wouldn't be any, you know, space alien abductions or assassinations of politicians or whatever, or, you know, romantic sojourns in Hawaii. So I knew what would happen in the most general sense, but I did not start writing it with intent to make those things happen, but rather to spend time approaching those events or arriving at those events and then see what happens in that approach. And then at some point, after some editing, you know, it becomes a novel.
Alexandra Hemon, before we go into that, let's do a little background here on who you are, because then we could put it in the context of not merely Lazarus Project, but your two other books as well. You're born in Bosnia.
That's right, yeah.
And lived in Sarajevo.
That's right, until 1992, when I came for a visit to the United States and then stayed after the war started.
Is the material in Question of Bruno pretty much your history?
No, it isn't. It is obvious to me and to anyone who has read the book why people think that. But at some point, it stops being autobiographical or biographical. I would think that ideally what I write transcends the personal. And I'm never limited by that. You know, there are certain things that happen to me there. And those things include moments that I absorbed or sensations that I remembered, as well as what you would call major events, say getting a job or getting fired or whatever happens to the people in my first two books. But at some point, those stories, I lose them. That is, they start becoming belonging to the characters in the book. I become all those characters, and once I leave the book, it stays with them. And there are, in fact, quite a few instances of memories, as it were, that I put into my books, and then I forgot about them. That is, I can't remember whether they're memories, so I made them up. Now they belong to my characters.
So you don't even know all the time whether you're dealing with fiction or memoir.
That's right, yeah, because it does matter to me. There's the inherent logic of the story that I want to tell, that I respect and follow. So if I need to embellish what happened to me to the extent that it stops being something that happened to me, I do it with no compunction whatsoever. I have no interest in writing nonfiction memoirs. For one thing, I don't find my life sufficiently interesting. But it's also, it's limiting. I worked with journalists and still write for a magazine in Sarajevo and have a great respect for historians. I do respect facts, but what I write is not based on facts. It's based on language, as it were. And I throw it all into that big cauldron of language, experience, imagination, gossip, whatnot. And then what comes out is neither a memoir nor not a memoir. It's neither fiction nor not fiction, to my mind. The question is in many ways completely irrelevant. It is what might have happened. And my job is to convince the reader that, in fact, it might have happened.
You came to the U.S. in 1992. How old were you and why did you come here?
I was 28 and I came because I had been a young journalist. I was young and I was a journalist. And the United States Information Agency, now defunct, which was the agency that, say, ran the cultural centers, the United States cultural centers all over the world, they invited me for a short trip, a month, at their expense. And I visited, you know, all kinds of people. I asked them to set up interviews with journalists and film directors and writers. And after that trip was over, I stayed for another month or two to see some friends in Canada and a friend in Chicago. While I was visiting that friend in Chicago, the war in Bosnia started, and I stayed in Chicago, which is where I live now.
Did you have any sense when you left Bosnia that something like that would come down?
I did. But, you know, it's not a simple matter. You, at the same time, know, and you can't believe it. You cannot imagine what might happen. You cannot imagine your own life disintegrating. I think, generally, in human beings, there's a psychological mechanism that prevents you from imagining the moment of your own death. Because if you could, you would go crazy. If I could, I would think about it all the time. I think about it a lot anyway. But similarly, you know, you can't imagine that your life as you know it, which feels ideally stable and, you know, rooted in something that can simply vanish overnight. So I was a journalist, and I had a lot of information, more than the public, and the public had a lot. We knew what was happening. I mean, we knew that the Serbian army was preparing the war. We knew everything that needed to be known, but I just could not imagine it happening at the same time. It's another, you know, interesting relation between fiction and facts. You can have facts and still cannot be able to imagine what is going to happen. So I did, in fact, plan to go back. I mean, I had a return ticket, and I hoped, even while things were starting to happen in Sarajevo, that somehow it might stop. I would call my mom from Chicago in April of 1992, which is, you know, the very beginning of the war, and ask her how things were, and she would say, they're already shooting less than yesterday, as though it was, you know, rain, and then it would just stop because it could not go on forever.
When did the snipers, and I know that there's a main street in Sarajevo where people can fire, the snipers can fire down upon, when did the snipers actually show up there?
Well, in April.
They did, yeah. Pretty much at the beginning.
Yeah. There are various ways to, you know, define the beginning of the war, but on April 6th, 92, there was a demonstration in front of the Bosnian parliament where the citizens of Sarajevo were protesting against the war, a coming war, against nationalist parties organizing a war. And then there was sniper fire there, Serbian nationalist party snipers organized by Karadzic and such, who shot at the demonstrators. And then there was also shooting from across the river. But it was an organized action where the snipers shot at, you know, people who were merely protesting against the war. And the first victims, they have names. They were shot at that demonstration. Suada Dilberović and Olga Sučić, two women. One of them was a very young woman, 17-year-old, I think.
So you found yourself here in the States, at which point you realized you couldn't go back till the war ended and your writing career began.
I could not see the end of the war, and I had to go on with my life. So I decided I would write in English because it seemed that I would live here for a very long time, possibly for the rest of my life, which turned out to be the case. Not the end of my life, but living here. So I decided to write in English because I could not write in my native language.
Let's skip to your new book, Lazarus Project, now. After writing Nowhere Man, you began working on this book. How did you discover the story of Lazarus Averbakh?
A friend of mine passed a book on to me. It's a little historical monography called An Accidental Anarchist, written by Joe Kraus and Walter Roth. And it talks about the Lazarus Averbakh killing. And I read historical books randomly simply because I have them. And I read that one, and it was very interesting, the story of Lazarus. But what was even more interesting, and I think that's what triggered the book, or the writing of the book, was the photo of Lazarus Averbakh sitting dead in a chair in a worn-out suit, barefoot socks with holes. And behind him there's a police captain in a bowler hat and a very pale face, trimmed beard. He's as alive as can be. And Averbakh is dead. And there's this inherent cruelty of the situation, the voyeuristic gloating of this, you know, photo. Look, he's dead. We killed him. But there's another photo of Captain Evans and Averbakh. And this picture, Averbakh is still sitting in the chair. It's in profile. But the police captain, Captain Evans, he's moving. And since this was shot in a morgue indoors, it required long exposure. So as Captain Evans is moving, his face is smeared. So he looks like a ghost. Whereas Averbakh in his death is not moving, he looks more present, as it were, than Captain Evans. Of course, Captain Evans is dead now, too. And these two photos, they just obsessed me. And I realized over time, around that time, that I would have to write a book on Lazarus and that I would have to include those two photos somehow.
Well, Alexander Hemin, at that point, did you realize that this would be a double story, the story of the research and that person, or was it originally going to be just a historical story?
Well, for a little while, it was going to be just a story on Lazarus Averbakh, but I have a hard time writing the so-called historical fiction where you accumulate a sufficient number of plausible details and pretend that you know what people thought or felt at that time. And so I thought of the other storyline of two people, two Bosnian men going to Eastern Europe to research this story. One of them is a photographer, the other one is a writer. And I wanted to follow that storyline too, and I wanted, this came to me very early that one of the characters would be a photographer, so I could include those photos too in the book.
And at that point, I guess Velibor was your friend, the photographer?
Yeah, Velibor Borzovic.
And he lives in Montreal?
He lives in Montreal right now, yeah.
So at what point did you decide, hey, let's do the trip that I'm writing about?
It was early. It's the same decision. When I realized that there would be a photographer character, I realized that we could go together and, you know, do the trip and take some photos.
You went to Lviv, Ukraine, and then did the car ride to Moldova and then over to Sarajevo, just like the characters?
Yeah.
What was the real cab ride like?
The one from Moldova to Bucharest was crazy because the driver was a maniac and he nearly killed us driving 120 miles on Moldovan roads, mind you, in Romanian, which you would not call highways or even good roads. But there were no other people present and there was no violence involved, unlike the book.
And there was no girl in the car with
no,
you?
No, I made that up. But when we went there, we went for a trip and I thought, oh, maybe I can write about this. We went there thinking that the trip would be integral to the book. And so we would sit around, say in Lviv in a coffee shop and speculate or imagine what Brick and Rora would do, what Rora would shoot in that situation, what, you know, how would Brick feel. We would sometimes talk about it, sometimes we just look around with their eyes.
So he was kind of almost a collaborator on that part
of
the story.
Yeah. The way I like to describe it is that we wrote a script together, then I shot it.
There's actually a third story interweaving between those, which is the story that the fictional photographer Rora tells the fictional narrator Brick, which is the story of life in Sarajevo and involves a gangster named Rambo and a newspaper man named Miller who has the same name as the newspaper man back in Chicago.
Yeah, yeah.
Was any of that story based on real stories that you heard?
Yes, the gangster stories are far too real, unfortunately. The Rambo character is a composite character. Some of the things obviously I made up and invented, but there was a whole category of characters in Sarajevo, much like that. And some of them, few of them, as you would expect, are still alive because they tend to shoot at each other once the war is over. It's sort of a Darwinistic milieu. People from Sarajevo would recognize, you know, hints and references and myths and anecdotes about those people. I knew a lot of those stories, obviously, for a number of reasons, but also in preparation for the book in Sarajevo, at the end of our trip, I talked to my friends in the press in Sarajevo who briefed me on the situation of the war, drew little maps, you know, positioning various characters of that kind in the city and so on. So that required some research too.
Had you been back to Sarajevo? When did you first go back?
I went back in 97 for the first time, which was a year and a half after the war, in the spring of 97.
Were you kind of shocked at what it was like? Was the change just subtle and scarier that way, or what?
It was scary. It was not subtle because almost every building was damaged, and you could see the points of impact of the shells on the pavement in the city, including the shells that killed a large number of people. In Sarajevo, at that time, they filled up those points of impact, those spots, they look like a drawing of a sun with rays spreading from the center. And some art group, they filled it out with red paint, and people in Sarajevo call them roses, which is a very ironic way to describe it. But in any case, there were a lot of those things, and everything was fascinating to me. Fascinating is maybe not the right word, but I kept looking at everything. But the strange thing was that everything was the same in some ways. I mean, the geography of the city did not change, but everything was different. And my body remembered the before the war city, and then at the same time, my body was experiencing an entirely different space. And it took me a while to get used to that. I go two or three times a year, and by now I'm, you know, past that initial shock, well past the initial shock. It's intense, and it's the way that memory and experience works. I was walking down the street the first time I went back to Sarajevo, walking down the street and alone and, you know, thinking about whatever. And then at some point I turned to look at something, and I wondered why I had turned. And then I realized that I was looking at the place where movie posters used to stand. This was my habit. When I walked down the street before the war, I would look at what movies were playing at this place. And my body remembered this action. You know, there were no movies playing. I wasn't going to go to the movies the first thing after coming back to Sarajevo. This was in the first couple of days. But somehow my body, it's not even muscles. I don't know what it is. I remember this. And, you know, it was a conditioned reflex, but I retained it after 5 years or so of absence.
You're listening to an interview with Alexander Hemin, whose latest book is The Lazarus Project. Alexander Hemin, you said you became obsessed with the Lazarus Averbach story, the story of this young Jewish immigrant who goes for some unknown reason to the home of a police chief and is gunned down as if he's a terrorist and he's just a person. Why do you think that particular story obsessed you?
Well, the first thing is the tragedy of Lazarus Averbach, who was a pogrom survivor. He survived the infamous pogrom in Kishinev in 1903 and 1905. There were two of them. His whole family, which was horrendous in more ways than one. And then he came to the United States because his sister was here. And only after 7 or 8 months in Chicago, he was gunned down. And there's this tragedy of not being able to escape the history, whatever sense of history pursues us, or whatever sense we might have that history pursues us, he must have had it. But it's also, you know, the uncanny resemblance with the contemporary, quote-unquote, war on terror, where people are guilty by association or by suggestion, as it were. When Chief Shippey saw him, in his own words, he knew, he said, he was up to no good because the original words were, he looked Armenian or Sicilian, that is, his skin was darker. This was enough for Chief Shippey to gun him down. And when I did research in the reading newspapers at the time, you would find editorial cartoons say, you know, a dark-skinned hand would be coming down with a knife, and then it would be a white hand holding up this hand, and the caption would say, law and order. Then there was another cartoon in which an enraged Statue of Liberty was kicking a cage full of foreigners. And you could tell they were foreigners because they had hooked noses, you know, pronounced chins and curly hair and bombs and knives. And then the caption said, enough, that is enough. You know, this is still early in the, so to speak, in the history of American immigration. And it was enough then for some people. So this, it was fascinating to me. It did not surprise me, I have to say. And the other thing was that immigrants were politicized in those days. You know, there was a whole range of political options in each ethnic immigrant community. There was a daily socialist paper in Chicago. And there was, you know, each ethnic group had an anarchist society or socialist society. Right now, you know, you're either happy to be here as an immigrant or you should get the hell out of here, or you're illegal and you can't say a word. You know, there's this bullying patriotism in this country that I cannot stand for a moment. But somehow immigrants back then, they were not bullied by that. And that to me was fascinating. It was possible to come here and work in this country, work hard and still have political opinions without feeling demeaned. And the pressures were just as hard. It's not that, you know, Shippey and such thought, oh, you just be an anarchist, we don't have a problem with that, or socialist. They were called the Reds. There were regular raids by the police. You know, there were random arrests after the Averbach affair and all the time. There were anti-immigration laws. There were deportations, all that. Yet, you know, immigrants were political. And I like that. I like that. I like the thing that there was some way to offer resistance.
In an interview I read that you gave, you talk a lot about, I guess, or maybe it's a subtext, about American exceptionalism, as if Americans feel that somehow this is the moral country. And when we fail, as in Abu Ghraib, it's somehow more of a tragedy because we're somehow a better country, but we're not. We're just another country.
The myth of good intentions, that even now, after this, the 8 years of absolute disaster of the Bush administration, some of you can even find people, even the people who oppose the war, the Bush administration, they are willing to justify this catastrophe by saying, well, they had good intentions. You know, the so-called liberal hawks, people who were pro-war, they think, well, if the war was executed better, it would not be that bad. And I just find it unconscionable. But it goes even deeper than that. My doctor, a very fine woman, a gentle, generous woman, a physician, you know, I once told her that I was terrified and horrified and depressed because of the Abu Ghraib pictures. And she said something to the effect that, well, to think that even Americans would do something like that, as though Americans were the last people who would do that, you know, that somehow they're protected from whatever symptoms the rest of humanity suffers from. And this notion of good intentions justifies the crimes after the fact. So Abu Ghraib happened, but we didn't really mean it. You know, the Guantanamo Bay camp, you know, it's bad, but, you know, it's for a good reason, for a good cause, and so on and so on. You know, the CIA black sites, you know, it's all good because they really mean good. And if they are committing crimes, it's out of excessive patriotism, not out of any kind of malice.
which actually goes back to the schooling here, which is that that's pretty much what we're taught. And people here don't realize the relationship of fact and propaganda. They just don't know, which is why so many people bought into the propaganda of the Iraq War, I think.
I grew up in a socialist country, Tito. Every classroom had a Tito's picture in the classroom. And which we, you know, we at some point we started throwing sponges at the picture. It was a sport because you lose respect, which is a natural progression of a human life. At some point you lose respect for authority. But we never pledged allegiance to Tito or to the flag, right? Before soccer games, nobody sang the anthem or God bless Yugoslavia. You know, there's constant enforcement of patriotism where you have to jump through certain hoops, but nobody, it's not the law, you know. It's not that if you don't do it, it's okay, it's not a problem. But there's pressure to do it. And if you don't do it, you stand out. I have been glared at because I refuse to stand up for the anthem, American anthem, at a baseball game or soccer game. I just don't stand up for anthems at sports events, you know. It's just nonsense. Any society with ardent nationalists in it, or people who are in power and want to stay in power, they stay in power by enforcing their loyalty to some sort of abstract notion, which overrides any other kind of loyalty. So there's always patriotic bullies bullying you into being loyal. And if you don't, you know, you are beaten in the head. I think, as we all know, in this conversation is a piece of evidence, it's hard to bully people here, which is precisely why they're trying so hard. There's always going to be people who are not going to succumb to that.
Alexander Hemann, as you write these books, is it in a way a form of therapy or psychological therapy in terms of learning about yourself? Because you do stick, in all of your work, you stick very closely to your own experiences and your own feelings.
It is not therapeutical in itself. I mean, the action of writing is therapeutical to me, but so is playing soccer or skiing or walking or, you know, playing with my daughter. That is, it makes me feel better about the world and myself. But that applies to any kind of writing. And these particular books are not, I did not need to write them so I could recover from some sort of trauma. The problem of writing or imagining other people's lives is, you know, how much of someone else's life can you imagine? And I like to start from a personal position, from the position of the personal, and then expand from there. So I always start embellishing what might have happened to me, and then expand into others, as it were. The trajectory of my writing is from personal to not universal, but non-personal, let's say. Universal is too ambitious. In this process of transformation of personal experiences into transpersonal, let's call it, is what can happen in language, what is exciting for me in writing literature. So at some point, as I said, it becomes someone else's, all those feelings. Those feelings become, they start belonging to someone else. I become all of the characters in my book, not just those who resemble me. And that is, I was Miller, you know. I find the Millerness in me, you know, the obedient groveler part of me. And I wrote those lines that Miller writes about the Abergo affair with great, great pleasure. And this is what writing does. You expand into others in writing. I expand into others. And I think that's what reading does, too.
When you go back then and you're writing Brick, the character that's most closely related to you and his feelings, does that become kind of almost weirder then because you're suddenly back on yourself?
It does. And then my instinct is to question all that. You know, it's not that I root for Brick. Brick's position is the toughest one because he's the one that I want to attack and assault more. You know, I want him to not suffer, but to be exposed in his shortcomings more than others. You know, I recognize his self-indulgent monologues and his proclivity to self-indulgent monologues and, you know, the questionable notion that there's nobility in whining and self-questioning and so on. And so I can see that in Brick. But then I write those others, those that I could be, but I'm not. And that's just as fun.
Well, Brick is more of, as you put it, a navel-gazer than you are.
Yeah, he is. Yeah.
And Rora's the storyteller, which is also you.
Rora is a kind of an epic character, as in epic poems like, you know, Odyssey or the Iliad. The epic hero shows up in the narrative completed. They don't change. They don't develop. They don't have a psychology. You don't have to know their history to understand what point they're at in their lives. Because the moment they, you know, started acting, they acted the same way with the same logic. And Rora is much like that, but he's also a storyteller, and he tells those stories as though they were epic poems. You know, they're not about him, but about characters, one of whom could be himself. There are two modes of narration, therefore. There's a navel-gazing narration of Brick, and then there's this epic narration of Rora.
And then there's the story Brick is writing to.
That's right. And the way I imagine it working is that those two modes of narration, Brick's and Rora's, they somehow they get married in the story of Lazarus and Olga.
How much of the Lazarus story in the book is actually historical? I mean, just a very, very broad outline, then. Does Olga exist?
Olga does exist, but what happened to her after her brother's murder was a little different. But the fact of his killing is true, and the fact of the anti-anarchist hysteria in Chicago is true, and some of the names, Isidore Marron was a historical personality, but what happened between him and Olga did not happen in history. Assistant Chief Schuttler was a historical character. He was a well-known policeman in Chicago. And so in very broad outlines, the basic fact, the fact of Lazarus' killing is true.
There's a strange little story I alluded to a few minutes ago about human trafficking between Moldova and Romania, prostitution trafficking. Where did that come from?
When we were in Moldova, I interviewed a journalist, a Moldovan journalist, who was working on a story on the trafficking of Moldovan women, many of whom, in fact, ended up in Bosnia, or had been ending up in Bosnia. And it's a horrendous story, but I talked to her, to the journalist, about that. And one of the things she told me, which had defied my expectations, was that it's not a mafia business. There's no Moldovan mafia trafficking women. It's actually kind of a family business. A couple, a husband and wife, they, cheat or convince a couple of young women to go and look for work somewhere in Western Europe via Romania and Yugoslavia, and then they lure them into the network of, prostitution. But the people who would actually drive them, they would be individuals. They were not a part of network, and it was their own way to get out of trouble. So it was then in Moldova that this possibility in the story entered my writing.
One of the main keys of this book is the anti-immigrant fervor. There's a quote from you that the notion of immigrants as foreign bodies contaminating America is as old as it is persistent. What's curious about that, of course, is that white Americans are all immigrants. Black Americans, too, but most of them were forced here.
Yeah, but they did not enter a pre-existing societal structure. What they came to and what they saw was, the way they perceived it, was, a blank slate, a clean slate. There was nothing here, and then they came and they built something out of it. So they were here first, as it were, in their minds, whereas, of course, they were not. White Americans, even now, they think they might have built this, and those who come, they come into this, and they, they contaminate it, because it was clean and nice until people like me came. And so there's this notion of, contamination, and contamination always, not always, but often visible in dark skin.
When you came over here in 92, of course, Clinton became president right afterward, and then you stayed through the 2000 election. I'm sure that your family and friends were absolutely horrified. Because you're from Europe and from the former Yugoslavia, did you view 2000 any differently than they did?
I don't think I did. There was somehow acquired knowledge, my friends at least, from Bosnia, in terms of the workings of power. There's inherent logic to that, which is trans-cultural or trans-political even. Those who are in power, they like to stay in power. And to stay in power, they can do any number of tricks. But one of the tricks that always works is you have to have a nice enemy. And there's this delightful quote from George Bush, which I cannot possibly quote, actually, because it's so inane and incoherent. But before, in 2000, in June, in Iowa, I think, he said, when I was coming up, it was us versus them. And we knew who the them was, he said. But now the them is gone. And we don't know who they are, but we know that they are out there. You have to find this quote. It's completely, at the same time, completely incoherent and completely coherent. It explains everything. There were plenty of them in Bosnia before the war. Even in Yugoslavia, during Tito's times, we were taught that the enemy never sleeps. We did not know who the enemy was other than they don't sleep. And so there's that thing. There was also the practices the sort of the rituals of democracy displacing democracy as such. Not that Yugoslavia was a democratic country, but there were these rituals that united us all in a sense that we had. I was a kid, so it worked on me relatively more easily, made us believe that we participated in that power, whereas we didn't. Similarly, the 2000 elections, there was this dance, you know, around elections, and then it didn't turn the way many of the people wanted it to turn. Well, you know, then there were the Chads and the Supreme Court and all that.
Then we look at how, quote, journalists were in America and pundits. Were you more aware or cognizant of the nature of propaganda because you came from a country that worked in a more overtly propagandistic mode or not?
I was, but not. It was only because I came of age in the late 80s, early 90s, very early 90s, 91 really, and I was in my 20s then. And the communism, the Tito system, because Tito had died, was falling apart, and nationalism had not arrived yet. And so in this window of opportunities, people of my generation, we tore into the government. Our basic assumption was the government lies because they want to stay in power. This is axiomatic. They might do some good things and there might be some decent people in there, but this is axiomatic. This is what you start with as a journalist. They lie. Not for a moment, not because I had special knowledge, but because I had come from where I came from. Not for a moment did it occur to me that Iraq might have weapons of mass destruction. It was so obvious that it was a blatant lie. What shocked me and still does is that nobody really dug into this. You know, it's a big deal to start a war. I mean, it's a really, really big deal. People die in a war, but they just lined up and, you know, repeated press releases, essentially. And I'm thinking about it all the time. You know, nobody resigned. Not one pundit, not one editor, not one journalist. Nobody resigned. Not even Judith Miller. Resigned. Apparently, everything was creamy peachy. You know, well, we thought they had weapons of mass destruction, but it didn't. Oh, well, we'll write another story about Britney Spears. You know, who cares?
This one pundit, William Crystal, who has made predictions over the past 10 years, every single one of which has been wrong, he still got hired by the Times.
Right. Yeah, of course, yeah. There's a pundit, one of the columnists, I can't remember his name, but that's my favorite. After the Colin Powell fiasco in the United Nations, he wrote, "Only a fool or a Frenchman would now question the existence of the weapons of mass destruction."
Alexander Hemin, do you think it's possible then to actually write fiction that doesn't have, on some level, political content?
No, but I don't think, I, despite everything we're talking about here, my intention was not to write a political book as such. It's not to criticize this government, because there are other venues much more effective, to the extent they're effective at all, to attack that. I write a column for a Bosnian magazine in which I was vitriolic in relation to this, talking about all these events in the past 8 years. It is more a context for someone like Brick, and this is, I guess, one way in which Brick resembles me. I felt more at home in America before 2001. When this, you know, vulgar patriotism took over, I became more distant. I'm less at home now with the Bush administration than I was in 1999, you know, 7 years after I'd come, because I could not join the party. I could not tear the flag. I cannot, you know, get excited about our victories. I cannot respect the government that is led by people like that. I just can't do that. And so I feel more of a stranger now than before. And so Brick's problem, it's also very personal, that is, its problem with his wife, is precisely that he is less at home the more he digs into this history, because he, as it were, discovers that this is not, you know, a one-off. It happens time and time again.
The land of the free and home of the brave is not the land of the free and home of the brave.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But there's still, you know, a lot of space and reason to fight. It's a fighting ground. I like that.
Alexander Hemin, now that you've written Lazarus Project, where do you plan to go from here? Are you working on something else?
Well, actually, I finished something else already. I was writing two books at the same time. I wrote a book of stories at the same time as I was writing the Lazarus Project. Because I'm an impatient man, and I couldn't wait to see something published. And also, I needed to step out. So I would write a story, and it would be published in 2 or 3 months, mainly in The New Yorker. And then I also needed to get out of the Lazarus Project, have it sag a little, and then go back to it. So I finished two books, and the collection of stories is called Love and Obstacles, and it should come out next year, early next year.
Are these interrelated stories at all, or are they just separate entities?
Related to Lazarus?
No, to each other.
They are related, yeah. There's the same voice, the same central character. Yeah, they're related, but it's not a novel. They're stories.
Do you plan at some point to, I mean, you know, these are relatively small books. Does it ever occur to you to write that one big novel?
You know, Nabokov claimed that he knew a publisher who believed that every writer had a number of pages that he or she could not exceed, inscribed somewhere in their brain. And Nabokov's number was 385, he said. Mine, I think, is 300. So I don't think so. If it has 600 pages, I might just split it in two novels.
I went to your website, Alexander Hemin, and noticed that there are sections of Nowhere Man online that are not in the book. These were just cut at some point?
No, there are two little stories in which Pranik is the central character that I wrote, and they would not fit into the book. Pranik is a historical character. These are the two little stories where Pranik meets Stalin and then Hitler. Very short stories.
And the photos from Lazarus Project are also on your website.
Yes.
In a video.
Yes.
Did you do the video? Or?
I did it with Weber, with Zellibor, my friend. We put it together.
And also the material for Question of Bruno. Question of Bruno actually is just a complete listing of interviews and material.
Yeah.
It almost feels like three separate websites.
Well, yeah, you string them together because the first two websites were done when I was at a different publisher. And so, and also, you know, I published that a while ago. 8 years in terms of web history, it's two centuries or so. Things have changed beyond imagination.
Do you think that there's a future of combining print and media that has not yet been fully utilized?
I think, and I hope, that the book as it is, as it has been for the past, 2,000 years, or at least since the Gutenberg press, is going to stay around. It's too beautiful to go away. I think it might expand the reading material carriers, as it were, might expand. It's already a little different. You can read on the web, and there's the Kindle, the Amazon thing. But I don't think this thing will ever die. I really like that. I like the smell of paper. So they'll be, combined things, but it'll always be a book. And in the end, there'll always be language. We'll never be human beings without language. No matter what president does to it, we'll always have language.
You've been listening to an interview with Alexander Hemin, whose latest novel, or latest book, is The Lazarus Project. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.